From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we look at the evolution of the TV sitcom with the TV critic who's been described as our premier archaeologist of prime time, David Mark. Also today, when novelist Neil Basundith's characters flee the Caribbean, it's to escape political and social upheaval sweeping their birthplace. When Basundith left, the reasons were different, but the urgency was the same. Coming up, he talks about his new novel, A Casual Brutality. And we have reviews of the new album from Ashford and Simpson and the British film High Hopes. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. David Mark was born in 1951. In that year, the top-rated TV shows were Texaco Star Theater, Fireside Theater, Philco TV Playhouse, and Your Show of Shows. Of course, Mark was too young to watch in 1951, but he says that like most Americans his age and younger, he was an avid TV watcher long before he learned to read. He remembers spending many Saturday mornings in his Brooklyn apartment envying Joey Newton because he had both a TV show and a horse named Fury. TV informed Mark's fantasy life as a child. As an adult, he's come to think of TV as our shared culture. Since the mid-70s, he's been studying television history. He's described the subject of his writing as, quote, living with television and the culture that turns it on, creates it, rewards it, despises it, forgets it, and remembers it, unquote. David Mark has written for The Atlantic and The Village Voice and is an assistant professor at Brandeis University. His new book is about the evolution of the sitcom. It's called Comic Visions, Television Comedy and American Culture. Many of the old sitcoms he writes about are now on cable, where they've been repackaged as morality tales, nostalgia, or camp. But that doesn't quite describe David Mark's approach to watching them.
In a sense, I watch them as autobiography. If I'm watching, let's say, Nick at Night, Car 54, Where Are You? Will come up. In an objective sense, we're talking about 1962. In a personal sense, we're talking about me being 11 years old. And very much like oldies on the radio, they have a tremendous power, these artifacts of the moment, to recreate that moment for us.
Now, something that you've observed about Car 54, for instance, the program you just mentioned, is that it was the only show in a 15-year span in which there were regular black characters who weren't servants or domestics.
Yes, well, one of the things that I particularly like about that program, which was done by Nat Hiken, whose other work includes Sergeant Bilko, is that it has a real style to it. First of all, it was done in New York City during a period in which virtually all television production outside of the news had moved to California. Car 54 was shot at the old Biograph studio in the Bronx, where D.W. Griffith had made some of his silent era epics before moving to the West Coast. And you'll see street scenes of the Bronx in it. You have a variety of ethnic characters. And this was during the white bread period of the sitcom. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have, you know, Father Knows Best and Ozzie and Harriet and the Donna Reed Show and Leave It to Beaver really ruling the genre. And here is this crazy show where people are talking Yiddish and black characters are appearing in it and Italian characters. It really was almost a throwback to radio, where ethnicity had been very popular. I think one of the reasons ethnicity was popular on radio was that it was something you could do with sound. You could invoke the ethnic group with the accent, like in shows like Life with Luigi and the Goldbergs and so forth.
Well, as they point out, yeah, the shows like the Goldbergs and Amos and Andy started off on, you know, came to TV after radio, but they didn't last very long. Do you have suggested reasons why they didn't last long on TV, the ethnic shows?
Yeah, because what happened was when you took this exotic radio voice and put it on television, what had become something, you know, pleasant to listen to became a kind of racist joke. Think of the fact, for example, that Amos and Andy were played by two white men on the radio imitating black voices. A better example is the radio sitcom Beulah, in which a white man played the part of a black woman doing this voice. Now, when they went over to television, they actually considered, in the case of Amos and Andy, of having the two white stars, Freeman Gosden and Charles Correll, who also created and wrote that program, of having them do the show in blackface. But of course, that really would have been going much, much too far, as, and especially during a period where civil rights consciousness is beginning to come to some sort of fulcrum. You know, we're leading up to 1954 here in Brown versus Board of Education. So they went over to black actors. But here were black actors playing these stereotypes. And it truly became a kind of tasteless, racist joke at that point.
Your new book, Comic Visions, is really a history, in a way, of comedy on television. And you point out that at the beginning of television, when television first began, that there were a lot of shows, variety shows, hosted by people who had been stand-up comics. Milton Berle and Sid Caesar were two of the first big TV stars. But that finally sitcoms won out over sketch comedy and stand-up comedy. Why did that happen? You describe it as the comics being exiled to late night.
Yes. Today, for example, stand-up comedy is tremendously popular. Yet look at primetime television. There isn't a single regularly scheduled program that features stand-up comedy in all of prime time. And the reason for this is because in the early days, when they were experimenting, they tried all kinds of things. What they found was that there was something about comedy variety, sketch comedy and stand-up, that is, which was undependable. If Don Rickles or Milton Berle or whoever it was on, great. But what if they weren't on? What if they had a bad night? Think of it this way. If a stand-up comedian does a routine and the routine bombs, is it possible to say, okay, well, we'll retake that. Go out and do it again in front of the audience. Well, forget it. What could be worse than that? Whereas in sitcom, you can impose a kind of quality control by retaking the dramatic episodes. So it's like as the stakes became larger in prime time, how could you go to a big sponsor, a Procter & Gamble or a Pepsi Cola, and say, well, we think you should sponsor this show because the comedian is really good? That's a very abstract thing. However, when you could show them a finished product in the can, a product that could be modified, that could be changed, things could be taken out, it could be tested on focus groups and so forth, well, you had something where quality control could be imposed. You didn't have to depend upon the comedian having a good evening.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that took a great deal of the early spontaneity out of television, the so-called golden age of Milton Berle and Sid Caesar. That was really an experimental period, and the experiment was a failure.
David Mark is my guest, and his new book, Comic Visions, is about television comedy and American culture. You describe the early family suburban sitcoms as upholding gender roles, and you write, I want to quote you, you write, Lucy's schemes became ritual celebrations of female deference to patriarchal structures. I want to know if you thought in those terms at all when you were a child watching these shows. And I ask this because I certainly didn't, but on the other hand, there was always something that really frustrated me about The Honeymooners and about I Love Lucy. And I think I really felt that the women in those shows were really cramped, that Alice really had it bad. She was never going to get out of the house. She didn't seem to really love Jackie Gleason, except for the very end when they made up. Lucille Ball was always failing in her schemes and never getting fulfillment and always being put in her place. There was something hopeless about it to me, even though they were comedies.
Yeah, I think just on a kid's level, the fact that Ricky was in show business, and Lucy wanted to be in show business. And why couldn't Lucy be in show business? Because Ricky said so, that she should be home, you know, like cooking dinner and taking care of little Ricky, just as a kind of fait accompli, and no further explanation was necessary. But I would disagree with you in that I think that Lucy and Alice Cramden were very different characters. And Alice Cramden really could scream back in a way that Lucy never could.
Mm-hmm.
Lucy, at the end of every episode, after seeing the error of her ways, that she shouldn't go into show business, that she should be home doing the housework and so forth, sort of has to own up to Ricky and cry, you know, her famous wah, and, apologize. She'd just say, I'm sorry, honey, you know, and kiss him and so forth. Alice doesn't do that. Alice is angry. She's got all kinds of class anger and gender anger going on there. And when they make up at the end, it's just sort of superimposed on this narrative as a deus ex machina. It really doesn't come from anywhere. I think Alice is maybe the prototype of a female character that would emerge 20 years later, perhaps, and get her revenge.
You see the Dick Van Dyke Show as a real pivot point in TV sitcoms. What's special about it?
Yeah, the Dick Van Dyke Show was all alone in this period during the Kennedy era. It was neither an Eisenhower sitcom, as, let's say, Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, and the Donna Reed Show were, nor was it the Mary Tyler Moore Show, All in the Family, or MASH. It was the missing link between those two things. And there was a kind of progress going on there, where you have the wife who is still the housewife, yet Laura is given to us as someone who had a career as a dancer, who has talents and so forth. There are episodes in which she resumes her career even. I think what happened, though, that prevented a clean and easy movement to the later shows that I mentioned was the Vietnam War, where that whole process of gender role development was stopped in its tracks. And we go into this regression period of magic sitcoms like Bewitched and I Dream of Jeannie, because suddenly these observations about American family life, which had been very simple and innocent, became polarized because of political content.
And TV couldn't cope with it. That's when TV was really lagging very, very far behind the culture.
And no genre worse than the sitcom. I mean, if you look at the cop show, you've got the Mod Squad, you know, attempts to integrate women and blacks into the sort of archetypal white middle-aged crime fighter. Youth joins the police force and so forth. But here was the sitcom, the most representational form of all that's supposed to be showing us in our own home. And all of a sudden, genies and witches and Martians, it was a way of escaping from its representational heritage. And I think you also have the tremendous popularity of these rural sitcoms during a period when rural America is fast disappearing. The 60s were dominated by shows like The Beverly Hillbillies, which was the number one sitcom in terms of ratings for that entire decade, and other shows by Paul Henning, such as Green Acres and Petticoat Junction. And this is these are the most popular shows while, you know, riots are taking place in the streets and Vietnam protests are going on. Think of this. Gomer Pyle was set in the Marines during the principal period of U.S. troop involvement in Vietnam. And it's the story of a contemporary Marine. And the main problem in life is how to have a deep and caring relationship with your sergeant. You know, right. You never hear anything about the war or even about Vietnam. Curiously, there's one mention of Vietnam that takes place in the sitcom during the late 60s. And this was in a show called Julia. Julia was interesting because after the cancellation of Amos and Andy and Beulah in the early 50s, there was about a 15-year period where blacks simply didn't appear in any sitcoms. In 67, NBC brought Diane Carroll into a sitcom vehicle called Julia about a nurse who is a widow whose husband has died on the line in Vietnam. And the reason that was done was to sort of preempt criticism of the show by having the black character in it tied up with patriotism and so forth, in that her, you know, mm-hmm. her husband had died in the war.
You know, in talking about how poorly television did in handling the turmoil of the 60s and the cultural changes of the 60s, I want to bring up the subject of the Smothers Brothers. Many people have fond memories of what a provocative show that was, about how they took on the Vietnam War and other real subjects of the time, the counterculture. You went back and watched some of those shows and thought they didn't hold up at all.
No, they were mostly pretty boring. Though one thing that did interest me about this was the fact that the sitcom, which had so, as we discussed, so thoroughly triumphed over comedy variety, there was an attempt to bring back comedy variety in the late 60s. And the two great successes of that attempt were Laugh-In and the Smothers Brothers Show. And both of those shows had heavy political content in them within the context of what was going on in television at that time. The sketch material is awful. I mean, you know, if you in the ensuing 15 years or so, if you've been watching Saturday Night Live or SCTV or you know, other late night comedy shows, you absolutely wince at the kind of stuff that the Smothers Brothers were doing. The most interesting thing about it is as a historical artifact, to see Pete Seeger, for example, singing an anti-war song during the Vietnam War. Yet with cable today and you know, other opportunities for television, it really seems kind of trivial to even have made a big deal about that.
Well, I want to talk with you more about television comedy, but first we have to take a short break. David Mark is my guest, and his new book is called Comic Visions, Television Comedy and American Culture. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest David Mark teaches at Brandeis University. He's written about television for The Village Voice and The Atlantic Magazine, and he's the author of the new book, Comic Visions, Television Comedy and American Culture. It was sitcoms like The Mary Tyler Moore Show, MASH, and All in the Family that brought a new cultural relevance back into the form. You say that when Mary Tyler Moore was originally written, before it made it onto TV, she was supposed to be divorced. But the person from CBS Research didn't like that. He said there were three things that the audience wouldn't stand for: people with mustaches, people living in New York, and people who are divorced. Those three weird things to point out.
Yes, well,
was the mustache a joke, by the way?
No, facial hair was considered to be a very negative thing based on focus groups that were done.
A hippie trait, yeah.
It was a hippie trait, or you know, weirdo professors, or things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you see beards on characters in old sitcoms almost always to indicate that they're some sort of social deviant.
Mm-hmm. Is this a turning point for the role of research in television, where you've got somebody from CBS saying she can't be divorced, the American public isn't ready for that yet, make her just single?
No, it's not a turning point in research, in the sense that the research has always been done. What it proves is that this research is by no means scientific. I mean, here's the problem. You want to go to a big corporation and have them spend $500,000 to advertise on a show. You can't say to them, we think you ought to spend $500,000 for 30 seconds of time, because this is a wonderful show. This is terrific. Everyone in the office loved it. What you have to do is show them charts and graphs to scientifically prove that housewives making between in families that make between $10,000 and $25,000 a year cannot resist this. And so these sort of phony sciences, usually under the umbrella of the word demographics, have been invented. And using the rubric of science, this is given as hard information. Of course, it's not hard information at all. Michael Dan at CBS at that period didn't think a divorced woman could go. It had never been done before, and he didn't want to do it. So he went out and had the questionnaire survey research done that proved his point. Well, somebody else went out and proved that it could be done. This is not science.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have Mary Tyler Moore, MASH, and All in the Family bringing a new literary level, in a way, into the sitcom. And then black characters start returning to the sitcom in shows like Sanford and Son and The Jeffersons. And then you say that the literate sitcoms are just replaced by Gary Marshall's return to normalcy, shows like Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley, Mork and Mindy. What changed in the climate of television?
Well, I think it's more what changed in the climate of American culture. You had this kind of euphoria at the end of the 60s in popular culture, where there was a new set of rising consumer heroes. Women now were controlling a much larger percentage of the consumer dollar. a black middle class that had to be appealed to was beginning to emerge. And youth was replacing older viewers. Previous wisdom had always been that you wanted to sell to 35 to 49-year-olds. Now it became clear that more money was being spent by 18 to 34-year-olds. I mean, this is the kind of memos, these are the kind of memos that were passing around at that time. Well, in order to reach these new groups, you had to refigure the heroes of these programs. So you get a show like All in the Family, where father doesn't know best, but father knows least. You get a show like MASH, where the military is shown not to be some paragon of virtue, but you get a pretty dismal image of the military. And the Mary Tyler Moore Show, where a single woman with a job is shown not as somebody who is in a trap, who really would prefer to have a husband and move to the suburbs, but actually likes to live that way. You know, about the Mary Tyler Moore Show, there had been quote, working girl sitcoms, going back to the early 50s. The Ann Southern Show mm-hmm. was one of them. Our Miss Brooks was another one. But in those shows, the woman was shown as trapped in this horrible situation where she was either trying to marry her boss, in the case of Ann Southern, or the biology teacher, as in the case of Our Miss Brooks. But now this was a real difference. Mary seemed satisfied with her life. The guys she dated were often jerks, and she was well rid of them. The fact that this was also happening to a greater degree, with more single women around, with more women postponing marriage to later on in life, this was no coincidence. This was finding the new consumer heroine.
Let's move ahead to the present. I'm curious what you think of the nuclear family shows that are on now, shows like Cosby, Roseanne, Family Ties, Growing Pains. I know they don't fall neatly under one description or opinion for you, but do you think that they, like their predecessors, are upholding traditional values, or are they taking a different cultural view? Do you enjoy the shows?
I think that there is a lot of continuity there, and that there's a lot more variety than there once was. For example, The Cosby Show and Growing Pains are often pointed to as, you know, Father Knows Best a la the 1980s. But at the same time, you'll have a show like My Two Dads.
Right.
the premise of this show is that a little girl being brought up by her mother, and the mother has died, and it's not clear where paternity can be pinned in this, and there are two candidates, and so the judge demands that she move in with the two possible fathers, and they both bring her up. Now, this kind of thing could never have happened before All in the Family and shows like that, because of the sort of updating of the mimetic agenda that Norman Lear did. By that I mean, there had to be a refiguring of this pastoral family situation. Another interesting thing that happened to the black sitcom, especially in the 70s, was you had shows like Webster and Different Strokes. The idea that... both of these shows, I think, are shows where the producers would talk about progressive values, how they wanted to show blacks and whites living harmoniously and so forth. But if you look at these shows, you have black children who are being brought up by white millionaires and or wealthy upper middle class white people, and somehow they end up being just like white children. And it's a very dire implication there, that somehow if you could take black children away from the ghetto and place them with these all-knowing, all-loving white parents, they would turn out to be these little model citizens. So I think, you know, it's going off in a lot of different directions since those changes were made. But I think the important thing was that at the time, people believed that the sitcom was entering into this sort of new world of, permanently progressing complexity. And it wasn't true at all. Shows like Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley and, to some degree, Different Strokes showed that the sitcom could return to its sort of silly and banal heritage just as easily.
In your first book, Demographic Vistas, you wrote that you were convinced that American television had defined itself as a comic medium. Do you still think that's true?
Yes, and in fact, I think that it bolsters the point to look at these so-called dramas, shows like L.A. Law, and even to some degree Wise Guy, which really depend on their comedy to be interesting. L.A. Law, devoid of its comic lines, in other words, with simply its more dramatic or tragic aspects, would be an utterly boring program. The comedy is really what makes it happen. And I think that some of the best energy in comedy, especially at MTM Studios, realized that they were at a kind of cul-de-sac with the sitcom, and that they needed to move over into this dramatic situation to do even better comedy than they had done previously.
What are your favorite shows on television now? Are there shows you look forward to every week?
Yeah, I really like Wise Guy a lot. I think that Ken Wall's performance in it and generally the writing of it is very, very strong, very full of allusion, making fun of everything from the record industry to television. I think people in popular culture tend to do the best job, especially with satire, when they make fun of themselves. If you wanted to find out about the Napoleonic Wars, better off going to the library. But if you want to find out about the TV industry or the entertainment industry, turn on TV, especially shows like Wise Guy and L.A. Law, which are full of good criticism of television itself.
Mm-hmm. How much time a day do you think you spend watching TV?
Well, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. I would say that most of the time I spend watching TV is spent switching channels. There's no reason most of the time to stick with any image on the 40-channel cable spectrum for any time longer than it's interesting. So I'll watch something on one channel. What will that be? Something interesting visually, a bit of dialogue, a sex object, or whatever it might be. And the moment, even the vaguest hint or notion of boredom enters into it, switch to the next image. And so this idea of prospecting or searching is much more interesting. You know, the montage one creates is far more interesting than the vast majority of the shows. I know that this is a horror for sponsors and for the industry, but it's simply true. And it may force them to come up with programs that are more interesting than the montage.
You teach television at Brandeis University, and you've written two books about it, many articles about it. What do you say to the people who think that television is ruining or has already ruined the American mind?
I think that there could be no more eloquent reason of why it needs to be studied. This division between high culture and low culture and trying to keep low culture out of the academy has simply become a device for people to protect little fiefdoms in literature or film or, you know, whatever it is they're doing. If an English department were truly interested in the English language, it would in fact be teaching more courses on television, which has become the vessel of the language, than it would in literature.
Well, David, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Terry.
My guest has been David Mark, and his new book is called Comic Visions, Television and American Culture. It's published by Unwin Hyman. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Mike Rose. Rose teaches reading and writing to the educational underclass, people who have been defined as remedial or intellectually deficient. In his new book, Lives on the Boundaries, Rose tells of his own poor performance in school, his placement in vocational education classes, and how he was able to rise above the low expectations of his teachers. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Novelist Neil Basundeth has followed in the footsteps of his uncle, the writer V.S. Naipaul. Like Naipaul, Basundeth grew up in Trinidad in a Hindu family, and when he left the island to go to college, he left for good. Coming up, Basundeth tells us the meaning behind the title of his new novel, A Casual Brutality. Also today, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by the songwriting and performing duo of Ashford and Simpson. And guest film critic Stuart Klawans reviews High Hopes, the new class satire by British director Mike Lee. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. John Tower says he'll return to private life in Texas now that the Senate has rejected his nomination to become Secretary of Defense. The 53-47 vote against Tower delivered a bitter defeat to President Bush in the opening months of his administration. In New York, where the president is speaking on drugs and education tonight, White House officials said the president wants to put the Tower battle behind him. NPR's Mike Schuster reports.
President Bush reacted to Tower's rejection by the Senate without anger or recrimination. According to White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater, the president said Tower has always held the interests of the nation above all else. And Fitzwater said, Mr. Bush had words of personal sympathy for Tower.
John Tower's lot in the past weeks has been a cruel ordeal. For this, the president is truly sorry for both him and for his family.
Fitzwater denied that the Tower defeat was a setback or an embarrassment for the president. Fitzwater said the White House has already begun consideration of a new nominee at the Pentagon, but the spokesman refused to say how soon the nominee would be named. I'm Mike Schuster in New York.
Eastern Airlines has filed for bankruptcy. Eastern management says it plans to rebuild the company, but union leaders don't believe it. They say Eastern's parent company, Texas Air, wants to sell Eastern's assets piecemeal because they're worth more individually than the company is worth operating as an entire airline. Earlier today, Eastern agreed to sell its facilities and routes at Philadelphia International Airport to U.S. Air. The Machinists Union, which has been striking Eastern since Saturday, says it will challenge the sale in court. The union also says it's launching a consumer boycott of Continental, the other airline owned by Texas Air. Israel's foreign minister, Moshe Arens, is on his way to Washington, where he's expected to meet early next week with President Bush and Secretary of State James Baker. NPR's John Hockenberry reports that Israel is in no hurry to propose a new peace initiative.
Israel believes that the United States' position on Middle East peace is very close to its own. A senior Israeli official told NPR today that there have been some, quote, pleasant surprises from the Bush administration. The U.S. has let it be known that unlike the Soviet Union and the Arab world, the U.S. basically does not support an international peace conference, according to the source. The source in the office of Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said that the pressure is now off Israel to come up with its own peace plan. There will be some ideas to ease tension in the occupied territories, but Israel will not be offering any peace plan, the source said, now or next month when Shamir comes to Washington. An Israeli foreign ministry source said today that because George Bush's position is very close to Yitzhak Shamir's, the U.S. is no longer a, quote, mediator in the Middle East conflict. As recently as a month ago, the Shamir government was said to be working on its own peace plan. With the U.S. in our corner, said a foreign ministry official, there is no need. I'm John Hockenberry in Jerusalem.
The United States today ordered a Soviet diplomat to leave the country, accusing him of spying. State Department spokesman Charles Redmond said Yuri Paktusov, a member of the Soviet military mission, received classified documents from an American employee of a firm with classified government contracts. He declined to identify either the American or the company. A House subcommittee today passed a gradual $1.30 increase in the federal minimum wage. Meanwhile, Democratic leaders said they're willing to compromise with the Bush administration by adding a reduced training wage for new workers. The move to raise the minimum for the first time in 8 years was approved on a party-line vote by the House Labor Standards Subcommittee. The bill is nearly identical to one approved by the Senate Labor Committee yesterday. It would raise the minimum drinking age to $4.65 an hour by 1991. Stock prices fell slightly on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 4 points to close at 2291.43. Declines led advances 6-5 on a volume of 127 million shares. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Ashford and Simpson are a married couple who write songs about being in love. They started their career writing for others, but when they heard those songs being made into hits, they decided to record and perform themselves. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of their new album, Love or Physical.
Sometimes it seems as if it must be a lonely job, but it's one that Nick Ashford and Valerie Simpson have taken upon themselves to perform. While pop music trends vacillate wildly from rebellious outbursts to sedate calls to order, Ashford and Simpson have been singing about the joys of monogamy and middle-class comforts for almost two decades now. In a sense, this is as unpopular a position to hold as that of a Satan-worshipping heavy metal band. Ashford and Simpson have always presented themselves as friendly and open, and their music is clever and catchy, but their career is a trickier, more difficult achievement than it might seem.
In your arms, I can reach for your soul. Feel the truth in your heart. Dream of magical nights when you hold me.
And in your arms, shines in your eyes, sweetness sails on your breath. Ooh, hunger burns deep inside when I hold you, and
the list of Ashford and Simpson's hits is pretty well known. As freelance songwriters in the 60s, they were responsible for Ray Charles' Let's Go Get Stoned and a series of sexy, melodically inventive compositions for the team of Marvin Gaye and Tammy Terrell. Ain't No Mountain High Enough, You're All I Need to Get By, Ain't Nothing Like the Real Thing, and Your Precious Love, among others. The Marvin Gaye-Tammy Terrell duets were, in a sense, playing out in the recording studio Ashford and Simpson's relationship. By the early 70s, the songwriters decided that they might as well let audiences see and hear the creators of this music, the original models, as it were, and Ashford and Simpson launched their own recording career.
Now we fit together naturally, on most things I'm sure we agree, but that temper of yours that I found, I want you to turn it, turn it, turn it, turn it around.
That's Come With the Package from the new album Love or Physical. This album is a first-rate refinement of the music Ashford and Simpson have been making all along, a pop music that combines soul and gospel phrasing in a rhythm and blues context. In the hit singles they made earlier in their career, songs like Send It, Is It Still Good to You, and Solid, Ashford and Simpson rendered their marriage and hard work as ultimate values. They were yuppies before the term was coined, and in a way, their greatest achievement is to have made bourgeois upward mobility seem sexy rather than a sellout.
When they're not working at peak form, they can sound merely complacent, as they do on this album's title song. That's a new song asking an old question, is it love or is it physical? Ashford and Simpson aren't usually this cliched. Their best music works variations on conventional pop romantic discourse. There's a conservative edge to this music, and the era of AIDS would seem to lend an awful irony to this new collection of soulful hymns to solid relationships. More superficially, the popularity of singers like Anita Baker, Karen White, and Luther Vandross has created a fresh audience for this sort of music. But Ashford and Simpson aren't cashing in on a trend. They're extending a tradition of music that has to be taken on its own terms.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Ashford and Simpson's album, Love or Physical, is on Capitol Records.
No, there's never gonna be any harmony. And no one in the world's ever gonna be free. And just because it's true that we're all different, I won't be satisfied, I'll ever be content. Till we get it right.
This is Fresh Air. Neil Basundath grew up in a Hindu family on the island of Trinidad. College was his ticket out. He went to school in Toronto and became a Canadian citizen. His first novel, A Casual Brutality, is set on an imaginary Caribbean island he calls Casa Camada. The main character returns to the island from Canada where he was educated. He watches his island country turn into a police state. Basundath writes, "After the island received its independence, there we were then, free to make our decisions, free to make our mistakes, free to take the path that led eventually to nocturnal patrols of policemen clutching rifles." I asked him if the situation he describes in this novel is similar to what he witnessed in Trinidad.
Yes, it is. In one generation, Trinidad has gone from being an island where the policemen were basically tropical bobbies armed only with nightsticks to submachine gun-toting paramilitary policemen. It's a depressing change in so quick a time, and it comes directly from independence, which let me clarify what I'm saying here. I'm not saying that British colonialism was better than independence. What I am saying is that independence itself has gone wrong, and it's time that we started taking a look at what we have done to the concept and what we've done to ourselves.
Well, you describe the government and the military as being comprised of petty people wanting power, not reform.
Well, that's exactly it. One thing that the British failed to teach, I think, many of their former colonies was the idea of public service, the idea of building a country. What they did transmit was the idea of enriching oneself, of political power, as a means of filling one's own personal coffers. And that's, I think, a great tragedy.
The uncle of the main character in your novel refers sarcastically to people who change countries like they change clothes. When it gets too dirty, they leave.
Yes.
Have you heard that said?
Well, I've thought of it, and this is how I've thought of it, actually. I know a lot of people living not only in the West Indies, but in various parts of the world, who say would do anything to move to Canada or to the United States. But what they would do is wait until the very last moment, because living in some of these countries, they are busy enriching themselves, and they do not like the idea of having to leave without making an extra $10,000, $20,000, $30,000. So they will stay as long as they possibly could. When the island gets too dirty for them and it becomes too dangerous, then they will leave, go to another country. Unfortunately, more often than not, taking the very same attitudes with them. I've also thought of it in a way as using a safe country such as Canada or the United States as one would use a public urinal. I've known too many people who have gone to Canada, acquired citizenship, and then returned to their home islands. This was the plan in the first place. It was simply a way of getting a Canadian passport so that they could afford to return to their home islands, enrich themselves, and when things got too hot, they had a foreign passport to take them away.
Hmm. The opening of your book is set at the airport, and the main character is leaving the island to Canada, where he holds citizenship.
Yes.
And I'd like you to read an excerpt of that airport scene.
Certainly. Raj has, the main character, is just checking in at the airline counter. No luggage, no clothes, no books, no medical bag, not even a toothbrush. Just my passport, a one-way ticket, and in a canvas money belt strapped around my middle, U.S. bills and traveler's checks, and my Canadian citizenship and social insurance cards. The paper and plastic that, in our little island of Casa Quemada, are in themselves a definition of freedom. I reach for my papers on the counter. Is that all? I say. The young man nods, sucks his teeth, folds his arms high on his chest, hunching his shoulders into a bony fragility. He looks away with feigned indifference towards a middle-aged couple now emerging from the shadowed world into the light, each laboring with two bulging suitcases belted and marked for identification at the handles by swatches of red ribbon. They walk with studied slowness, yet give the impression of bustle, of people who want to run and manage to restrain themselves as they must, but only with transparent effort.
Why did you leave Trinidad?
I grew up dissatisfied with Trinidad. I found it always very small. I came from a family that traveled a great deal. My aunts and uncles and parents were always going off to Europe or North America. So I was aware of a bigger, more attractive world out there. And I found myself hemmed in. I found myself different. I was the only one in my circle of my age who enjoyed reading, and that set me apart. So that I grew up with dissatisfaction and looking forward to leaving. And when I left at the age of 18, I never looked back.
Your uncle is the writer V.S. Naipaul, who also grew up in Trinidad in a Hindu family and has lived in London since he went to college there. Was he ever seen as a traitor by the family for leaving and not coming back?
No, not at all. Not by the family. We understood that. The idea of being a writer was not one that you could exercise in Trinidad. It was simply too small and too isolated. Certainly coming from a place like that, you would run out of material to eventually. If you were to be a writer with this kind of background, you had to travel as he has. You had to find other subjects, other interests, other obsessions, I suppose. So no, in fact, the family is very supportive, very proud of his achievements. And that, I suppose, has helped smooth the way for me to become a writer, too.
In your novel, A Casual Brutality, the main character leaves the imaginary island of Casa Quemada and goes to Canada, to Toronto, where he goes to school. And there, in college, he develops a wariness of racial camaraderie. You write, it was visible minorities who most made me feel a member of a visible minority. Visible minorities who seemed most to draw the lines of difference.
Yes.
Is that something you experienced yourself?
Yes, it is. Toronto is aptly described as a multicultural city. You find there members of every race and every culture you possibly care to name. Something that I became wary of was walking along the street and having someone, a non-white, look at me and smile or nod or wink simply because I happen to also have brown skin. I resent that because it seems to me to be the racism of inclusion rather than the racism of exclusion. But it remains a kind of racism anyway. I don't see any particular reason to acknowledge someone's presence because of the color of their skin. I would more easily do it if I knew that we had a common interest in, say, writing or politics. But I've always been very wary of that because it seems to me just to be the other side of the coin.
Were you seen as a snob for distrusting this racial camaraderie?
Yes, I was, but that didn't bother me. There are some things to be said for snobbishness.
Did your parents believe in the caste system, and if so, how did that affect you, do you think?
No, my parents didn't believe in it on a daily basis. My grandparents' generation was more aware of it. But that was simply, as I saw it, part of the differences that they were drawing. While they were saying unpleasant things about blacks or people of mixed race, they were also busy dividing Indians into the various castes, and this was stunning to me. But they, of course, it was so second nature to them.
What caste had your family been in?
Well, I'm told that we're Brahmins, which means that we're supposedly learned men. But I'd like someone to define the word learned for me.
What do you mean? You sound like you don't really believe that they were Brahmins.
Well, no, I'm not disputing the fact that they were Brahmins, but a lot of the Brahmins and Brahmins learned in the ways of Hinduism that I've met have not impressed me intellectually,
mm-hmm.
So that I see no particular pride in being of a caste that has, in my experience at any rate, has proven itself to be rather vacuous.
Does it strike you as a little ironic that the place that you brought up and which you felt was very claustrophobic while you were there has ended up giving you very dramatic stories to write about?
I suppose it is ironic in a way, but we always write out of our obsessions, whatever they may be. I don't regret at all having grown up in Trinidad. I don't pretend that it never happened, but it is behind me. And I'm glad that it's there, it's useful material.
One last question. I want you to explain the casualness in the title of your book, A Casual Brutality.
It's one of my obsessions. It's something that frightens me, the way that violence or brutality can simply descend on one out of nowhere. This happens in North America. You can be walking along the street and suddenly be mugged. You have nothing to do with the mugger. You just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's terrifying. But also in third world countries, in a place like Casa Quemada that I've described, they... violence becomes almost institutionalized. It becomes part of the police way of doing things, the government way of doing things. But it is not planned with a computer. It can strike in fairly random ways. And that makes it very casual, very daily. It simply becomes part of life. People accept that. And that to me is terrifying.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Neil Basundith's new novel, A Casual Brutality, is published by Clarkson Potter. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel is joining us from Washington, D.C. to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert, how are you covering the continuing developments in the John Tower story?
Well, we'll be hearing from Capitol Hill and also from the White House. And we'll also talk with news analyst Dan Shore and with commentator David Gergen about what this defeat is likely to mean for President Bush and why the president went to the mat for John Tower when the effort seemed doomed a while ago. We'll also be hearing about an agreement in Warsaw between the government and Solidarity leaders to have a parliament which will include one chamber freely elected, a Senate. And we'll also hear about a video prepared by Samuel Beckett, instructions on how to produce his plays.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. High Hopes was the unexpected hit of last fall's New York Film Festival, and it's now becoming a quirky success around the country. Stuart Kluwans has a review.
Here's the formula for High Hopes. You start with a couple of working-class Londoners, Cyril and Shirley, who don't much like the way England's been heading. Even their house plants are an insult to the government.
What's that?
It's a cactus, isn't it?
Oh. Guess what its name is? Dunno.
Thatcher.
Because it's a pain in the arse, prongs you every time you walk past it.
Next, you add Cyril's widowed mother, who was about to turn 70 and has been withdrawing from the world. It's hard enough on her that she's becoming forgetful. What's worse is that all her old working-class friends have been pushed out of the neighborhood. Now, when she leaves her keys locked in the house, she has nobody to turn to, except for the sleek young gentrifier next door.
Just a minute.
I'm sorry?
Locked myself out.
Pardon?
Can't get in.
Ah, that's not a very clever thing to have done, is it?
Left my purse on top of the telly. Couldn't get my pills from the case.
Yes, but what have you done with your keys?
In my purse.
Ah. Well, aren't there any neighbors you know who could help you out?
Not anymore.
Finally, mix in the daughter, Valerie. Whereas Cyril is a dedicated socialist, which is something you don't get to see every day in American films, Valerie is a social climber who lives in the suburbs in a house that Liberace himself would have called overdecorated. She stays on the edge of hysteria all the way through the film and finally tips over near the end when she throws a 70th birthday party for her unenthusiastic mother.
Mom, pick up your glass. Pick it up!
Don't talk to her like that.
Cheryl, this is a family occasion, all right? I would like to propose a toast to Mum's birthday because it could be our last.
So, those are the basic elements. A mother who is starting to need full-time help, a daughter who can't even help herself, and a couple in their mid-30s who are risking a breakup. You see, Shirley still has enough optimism left to want a baby. But Cyril may have become too embittered for that. Well, that's a formula, too. But the wonderful thing about High Hopes is the way these various elements don't add up. Instead of a formula film, you get something that's unpredictable and changeable and alive, like a Chekhov play with disappointed workers in place of the usual lot of downwardly mobile aristocrats. How did High Hopes come to have such a sense of unforced comic realism? A lot of the credit goes to the way the director, Mike Lee, collaborated with the actors. First, he invented a set of characters. Then he assigned the roles and had the actors build them up through improvisation. The script came last. Lee didn't write it until he'd actually seen the characters come to life. You don't often see this approach in the movies. It's a lot more common in theater, the medium Lee comes from. And then if you do want to shoot films like this, it's a lot easier to make short ones, which is what Lee mostly has been doing in recent years, working for British television. High Hopes is only his second feature film. The first was made in the early 1970s. I'd say it's been worth the wait. Congratulations to him and to the actors who helped create High Hopes. Philip Davis as Cyril, Ruth Sheen as Shirley, Edna Doré as the mother, and the amazing Heather Tobias as Valerie.
Stuart Kluwans writes about the small press and film for The Nation magazine. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Ursula Le Guin says the only two things she knows a lot about are housework and writing. But in her 15 novels and 4 collections of short stories, Le Guin has changed the popular notion of science fiction and fantasy. Next time, Le Guin talks about balancing writing and motherhood. Also, critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Robert Cole's The Call of Stories and Wayne Booth's The Vocation of a Teacher, 2 new books on education. And we hear the music of pianist Kenny Barron in our weekly performance spot. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Naomi Person, Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Lisa Bruton. Production assistants from Ed Doherty. Research assistants from Christopher Cook, Peter Murdoch, and Ami Roosevelt. Our engineer is Audrey Vablaitis. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.